everybody. Welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Elise Glink, sitting in for John Williams. You can always find me online, thinklink.com or bestmoneymoves.com. That's my financial wellness technology platform. Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, but only if you want to see what I'm cooking or growing in the garden. And of course, check in Sunday with us. Tom Fortino and I host This Week in Wealth, where we talk about all sorts of interesting things relating to your retirement and your money. I met Lori Rudiman, must be 3 years ago or so, as I was making the rounds during a conference for Best Money Moves. It was an HR tech conference, and I remember sitting late at night at a bar with her and a couple of other superstars in that world, being so impressed with the fact that she was working on a new book called Betting on You, How to Put Yourself First and Finally Take Control of Your Career. And it recently came out. Lori, welcome to WGN Radio.
Well, Elise, it's great to be here. And please don't tell our secrets from that night at the bar, okay?
I promise. No more at all. But, I was thinking about you as I was looking at the numbers of people who are resigning from their jobs. The Great Resignation, as we in the media always seem to find a name for these things. So it's been called the Great Resignation, but people are leaving. There are more jobs available. Companies are having a heck of a time keeping employees, you know, in their employ. And I thought it was a perfect time to have you come on and talk a little bit about the work that you're doing, helping people identify what they really want out of their careers and how they go about getting it. Tell us a little bit about the book.
Well, Elise, thanks for asking. You know, I wrote the book before COVID, and I just had this philosophy that nothing changes unless you change, and that if we want to fix work, we need to start with fixing ourselves first. So I take the readers through a step-by-step examination of looking at, in a very fun way, who they are, what they're all about, and maybe stop identifying with their career so much. Be a little bit of a slacker, start to have more fun in your life, and then bring all that good stuff back to your career. And I think now more than ever, when the media is focused on the economy and jobs, it's really easy to get stuck in this trope where we define ourselves by work, but there's so much more to life. And in fact, some of the most interesting and successful business people have vast and robust personal lives. And if it's good enough for Mark Zuckerberg, it's good enough for you.
Well, it feels like that's, yes, if it's good enough for him, it would be good enough for all of us, I suppose. You know, give me a mistake, one or two mistakes that you think people are making with their careers right now as we're coming out of COVID and trying to move into some new normal.
Yeah, I think individuals are participating in something I like to call the great talent swap, where they're going from one job to another and maybe earning a couple bucks more, but they're finding that they're encountering the same old problems, the same old conflicts, and that's because they really haven't paused for a moment, stopped, reflected on what they really want out of this world, and gone after that. And instead, they're just chasing an old ideology of what a career means. And unfortunately, if you constantly hop on the hamster wheel, you're going to be going in the same direction over and over again. So for me, I'm asking people not to quit, as a matter of fact, just to back off of work just a little bit. Give yourself a little bit more balance. Dare yourself to say no. Dare yourself to take a vacation day and see if the job you're doing is actually okay or if it's truly time to leave.
We're talking with Lori Rudiman, who is a writer, a speaker, podcaster, author of this really great book called Betting on You, How to Put Yourself First and Finally Take Control of Your Career. You know, I think when people start out, Lori, they are so gung-ho about all the change that they're going to bring to the world of business, their own world, the larger global world or economy. And I think they feel like they're running right into a wall, particularly millennials and Gen Z, who have so much energy and see such big problems in the world and want to fix them. What's your advice for somebody like that who's just really at the beginning of what could be a 30 or 40 year career? How do you help them?
Yeah, You know, as a Gen Xer, I felt that way myself, and I remember encountering all of these boomers who are like, slow down, kid, you've got to pay your dues. And in retrospect, you know, I wish I had the bravery of a millennial to say, you know, up yours, I'm going to do what I want, I'm going to blaze my own trail, but I didn't for a lot of different reasons. I had student loan debt, like so many other people, so many other young kids at that stage of their life. And I think there's something to be said for a little bit of maturity and understanding that early in your career, you're still learning. But so many times we just stick with things because we feel like we've invested in the company, or I took a job and I can't leave because I've only been there for 6 weeks. And I think more and more when young individuals pay attention to their heart and their gut, they make better decisions. So if you're a young worker who's an up and comer and you feel like it's a bad fit within 6 days, 6 weeks, or 6 months, you know best what's for you. You should bet on yourself and definitely carve a new path, because the path you're on, the path you feel is broken, is really broken. You know what's best for you.
Lori, thank you so much. Those are really great pieces of insight. I think, you know, there's so much more in this book. Folks, you should pick up a copy of this book or order it online. Lori Ruderman is the author of Betting on You, How to Put Yourself First and Finally Take Control of Your Career. You can also find her and follow her on LinkedIn and LoriRuderman.com. Lori, we'll talk again soon, I hope.
Elise, always good to catch up with you. Have fun.
Ian Schur is editor-at-large of CNET. He joins us on Thursdays. Ian, there is so much news. I just can't imagine how we're going to get through all of it today, but I mean, let's start with Apple, shall we? It seems like they've got a big event next week, and they're finally going to announce something about those new Macs.
Yeah, there's been a lot of interest in how Apple's going to upgrade their computers. They have these chips that they're using called M1, which are designed using the same technology that is in a lot of the iPhones and iPads. And this is pretty important for the tech industry, not for normal people really, but what it means is that Apple is able to offer stuff that's actually thinner computers, longer battery life, all sorts of stuff like that. So the first generation of them came out last year. They got pretty good reviews from us at CNET. And this year, now it's kind of time for them to cash the checks they've written, right, to really show us what they can do. So it's going to be very interesting to watch what these new computers are able to do. And it may really change a lot of how the computer industry works, pushing us for even thinner and lighter and yet better battery life computers.
I have to say, and I am not being paid by Apple to say this, but I've had a Mac for a long time, and my kids have had Macs, and they, you know, compared with our non-Mac laptops, and I've got a bunch of those as well, I've been impressed with how, you know, with the old chip technology, the Macs have really kept up and been able to upgrade. And I know that my kids are looking forward to these new Macs because they think they're just going to take it into kind of the next generation, and they keep them for 7 to 10 years, which... Yeah. It was really hard to imagine for a non-Mac laptop. They just seem to, 4 or 5 years, you just have to get rid of them.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think Apple's really benefited from is what I tend to call good enough computing, right, where our computers and our phones and our tablets have gotten pretty good at this point to where you can hold on to them for a lot longer. I've got an iPad that is 4 years old, perfectly fine. I know a lot of people who are just upgrading their iPhones from, about 4 years ago. I have a MacBook Air that I use today that was made in 2013, so that's 8 years old. And it's really, that is part of the case here. But what's interesting, of course, is that Apple is a business, right? They're not a charity, and they do need to make money at some point. And so I think part of what's going to be interesting is what they announce on Monday, how it's going to make their devices that much more appealing, right? That much more of a reason to upgrade. That's always what us inside the tech industry are looking for, is what is the next great thing. But for people upgrading from, you know, like you mentioned, right, those older computers, this is going to feel like night and day.
Yeah, no, it is. Well, I want to talk for a moment or two about the used car market, because, you know, we all thought that by now the used car prices would come back down. They've been skyrocketing, as have new car prices. And if you're looking for a car, this is the wrong year if you're trying to save money.
Oh, my gosh.
But you're telling me, you know, but one of the things I'm seeing in your story today is that the peak, you don't think, or CNET doesn't think the peak has come yet.
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things I think people don't know about Sina is we've got this amazing team of car industry experts called Roadshow, and they have this really smart story about how the used car market is actually getting worse, not better. And part of that, I mean, anyone who's driven past a car dealership these days has noticed that there's like one or two in a lot, and a lot of the other stuff is used cars. And so far, the year-over-year wholesale prices have jumped almost a third for this September from last September,
wow,
which is just incredible. And even between August and September, they climbed. And so the expectation at this point is that used car prices are going to continue. And part of that is because of this chip shortage that we've been dealing with throughout the entire industry, where, you know, I know it's silly to think, well, why do chips stop a car from being made? But cars now have, like, multiple computers inside of them handling fuel injection, not just the infotainment and all that. And so as a result, Ford, for example, had to delay making their F-150s for a while because they just didn't have enough chips. And other companies are actually now giving you a rebate back because they can't have a certain computer system in their cars to make it work. It's incredible to see this happening.
Yeah, no, Tesla as well had they're all about chips, right? And so they had just a ton of cars just sitting in a lot somewhere, I think, waiting. Supposedly by the end of 2022, this chip shortage is going to come to an end. But I got to tell you, they keep pushing that out. And it's hard to imagine that we're going to see it. But thank you. That's it's interesting to know. I know a lot of people who have actually gotten calls from their dealers saying, hey, you've got this two-year-old car. We'll give you almost what you paid for it if you would just bring it back to us right now.
My wife and I are tempted with our used car, but at the same time, the challenge is, you know, well, how do you live without an extra car? And so it's actually a really interesting challenge for a lot of people to think about it. You could make a lot of money back, as you pointed out, but you are giving something up.
Yeah, you really are. And do you have any sense from your experts, in the new, who are looking at cars and sort of the whole automotive industry, anything big that's going to come down the pike that, you know, from their point of view, that's going to fix this? Either just a whole lot of new cars what are they going to do? Or do they have any ideas about how it's going to roll out?
Well, what's going to likely happen is that there are a couple of things that are going to, within the next 2 years, make this better. One is that a lot of the chip companies have invested in more manufacturing capacity. It's not as easy as just, you know, buying a warehouse and turning on the lights. Unfortunately, it takes them years to get them up and running. And so that is part of it, is that the demand has just gone through the roof. And they think that by, you know, that next couple of years, all of those extra lines will come online. But in fact, the car industry is going to need more chips, not less, partially because they're all starting to push into electric more and more. And of course, that requires more systems. So I'm really curious to see whether it stays in 2023 or if it even gets worse. But it's certainly clear that, you know, part of the way that we set up the supply chains over the last two decades are not handling the amount of demand that we all have right now.
Yeah, that's definitely not. Ian Schur is editor-at-large of CNET. There are so many great stories on CNET.com today. Do yourself a favor and take a look. Ian, we'll talk to you again soon.
Absolutely. Take care.
Jessica Lautz is with us now. She's Vice President of Demographics and Behavioral Insights for the National Association of Realtors. And she wrote a blog not too long ago, it was a day or so ago, on race, home ownership, and student loan debt. And I was thinking about this morning, Jessica, because of the Wall Street Journal story that I think was published today about Baylor. Well, it's not only about Baylor University, which the journal says has the worst repayment rate for Parent PLUS loans among private schools with a $1 billion endowment. But they talk about how parents owe $103.6 billion in Parent PLUS loans, which is puts all taxpayers on the hook for that. And it made me think about your blog and everything you're working on. So first, welcome to WGN Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, the Parental PLUS loans actually are a really big issue. We know that college costs are going up, and so parents end up taking on additional loans on top of what their children are. One of the really staggering statistics that has kind of blown me away, that's not in this recent blog post, but I've looked at this data, is looking at those who are over the age of 60, Since 2004, the amount of student loan debt that's held by individuals over the age of 60 has increased 1,900%.
Wow. That's unbelievable.
We often think of student loan debt as a millennial issue and a young adult issue, but it really impacts all generations, unfortunately.
Well, this is, it's of course, interesting because we talk about how baby boomers, and they would be in that 60 plus, I think baby boomers are like 57 or 58 this year and older, they haven't met a debt they didn't like. That's sort of a refrain, a common refrain in the real estate business. But I think it really puts, a fine point on it because the Parent PLUS loans are the reason that these 60-year-olds are actually getting student loan debt at their age, right?
It is. So it is Parental PLUS loans, but I do have to say the GAO has actually done a recent study, the Government Accountability Office, and it actually showed that it's not just taking on loans for children. People went back to school after the Great Recession. They took on additional degrees or certificates, and they took out loans for those. And so some of that is their own personal education as well.
So people who are in their 60s, oftentimes they already own a home, right? What is the home ownership rate for people who are baby boomers?
So for those who are older, we absolutely know that their home ownership rate is stronger. It's those who are under the age of 35 who are really suffering getting into home ownership. All of that said, even if you're currently a homeowner, but you've taken on student loan debt, that debt cannot be refinanced. There's really nothing that you can do with it except for really try and tackle that payment. So you might be stuck and you can't actually move because of the affordability crisis. And so that student loan debt actually goes into that equation of your debt to income ratio overall. And so many people may want to downsize or move to a more affordable area. But right now, given the housing affordability crisis, it's just not an option.
Yeah, I just did a piece myself on the idea that, you know, downsizing may not actually save you any money in retirement right now. You'd have to, you know, relocate, and that's typically out of state or to a more rural area. I want to get at this idea, though, about race and home ownership and student loan debt, because the Wall Street Journal article did indicate that, at a school like Baylor and other schools too, I don't want to just pick on Baylor, and my niece went there by, you know, full disclosure, but that minority families and minority kids seem to get loaded down with student loan debt more than white kids. And then they're, you know, the home ownership rate for blacks and Hispanics is so much lower than it is for whites. So what did you see in your research?
Yeah, absolutely. So we know that there's a disproportionate impact of student loan debt. Unfortunately, black graduates do graduate with more student loan debt, but they have a harder time paying it off. And it really trails them throughout their lifetime. They end up having lower earnings. And so it's harder for them to be able to tackle their debt. So 4 years after graduation, black graduates who successfully have a degree owe $52,000 compared to white graduates 4 years later who owe just $28,000. And that's going to impact their debt to income ratio, and it's going to really impact their ability to live their life.
It's just really unfortunate all the way around. Is there any, I know that your job isn't coming up with solutions for these things, but with the people that you work with and talk to in this world, you know, does anybody seem to have any good ideas about how to fix this?
So I will say that I'm a researcher, but I will say that our board of directors at the National Association of Realtors did actually vote, and they said this is something that does impact homebuyers. It's impacting our homebuyers who are trying to enter home ownership, and we're working with clients who are. And so they decided that there would be a number of policy issues that they would support, like refinancing or helping employers. If employers want to offer a benefit to help employees pay down their student loan debt, make that easier and make that happen. And then the last one is really financial literacy and getting that information in the hands of students and potential college students before they even enter into this process.
Yeah, we find at Best Money Moves, my financial wellness technology platform, we find that working with younger people is, it's a joy from our end, right? Because you feel like you're really having an impact there. But they're also so desperately hungry to right the wrongs that they feel like their parents may have made financial mistakes. This is an opportunity for them to try and get their life straightened out.
And it's good that there are some tools out there that help people understand the real cost of the loans that they're taking out when it comes to college. Baylor says that what they're recommending for some of their lower income families is a couple of years at a community college and then transferring into Baylor. I think that's a wonderful mm-hmm. idea for a way to cut costs.
Absolutely. And we know that even if living at home, if that's an option, that certainly cuts costs as well, because college is not just the tuition. It's the books, it's the room and board, and everything adds up. So I know that that's not an option for some students to live at home. One of the things I do want to say, though, is that if there's a silver lining in this study, it's that Gen Z seem to be going into this process with their eyes a little more open to what the costs are going to be. So maybe they learned from the millennials and the boomers before them and the Gen Xers to know what the college costs are.
It's great. Thank you so much for being with us. Jessica Louts is Vice President of Demographics and Behavioral Insights for the National Association of Realtors. We appreciate your help today.
Thank you so much.
Steve Grzanich is here now with the Wintrust Business Minute.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Chicago startups are still raising a record amount of money, even though the cash haul has slowed a bit in the third quarter compared to the start of the year. Crane's reports startups raised $1.45 billion in venture capital in 86 deals in the third quarter, citing data from PitchBook and the National Venture Capital Association. That's compared to $1.96 billion raised across 90 deals in the second quarter and $2.1 billion from 99 deals in the first quarter. Chicago area startups have raised $5.5 billion so far in 2021, the most raised by local companies since PitchBook started tracking the data. Walgreens Boots Alliance has agreed to become the majority owner of VillageMD. The drugstore chain is investing $5.2 billion to open hundreds of clinics with a Walgreens presence across the country. Walgreens' ownership stake will rise from 30 to 63%, but VillageMD will remain an independent company. The investment is part of Walgreens' broader effort to turn its stores into healthcare destinations that not only fill prescriptions, but also have doctors who can write those scripts and provide other types of care, including checkups as well. The goal is to have at least 600 primary care clinics in more than 30 U.S. markets by 2025 and 1,000 by 2027. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
And with the business of food, we have Steve Alexander.
Just when you thought there could not possibly be another way to shop for food online, here comes Sifter.shop. It's the brainchild of the Chicago brothers who started Peapod, Andrew and Thomas Parkinson.
They created Sifter to advance the shopping experience and promote healthier eating.
That is the CNO of Sifter, Chief Nutrition Officer, Registered Dietitian Judy Sable.
It's like shopping with a dietitian.
Judy says you can go onto the Sifter.shop site and create a profile with your specific dietary and medical needs and wants, or you can just choose one of the diet profiles built into the app.
Over 130 diets that one can choose from. And the Sifter tool is a sophisticated sifting technology that actually searches and sorts on all of the attributes that you factor in a very precise way.
And after Sifter does its thing and you see the foods that match your profile, then you can shop however you'd like.
Sifter is a discovery platform, and then you can easily purchase it from one of our affiliate partners. So whoever your favorite retailer is, we give you the selection and then we connect you with that e-cart. Or you could save it as a shopping list and then email that to yourself and print it later and shop in store.
Okay. How much does it cost?
There is no cost for Sifter. It's a free shopping site. And you print it, you go, and you do your shopping.
Well, that doesn't seem like a very good business model, but, these guys did create Peapod and sold it for a bunch of money.
Yeah, our business model actually is that we work with brands and CPGs, consumer packaged good companies, and we allow them to tell their story on our platform. We match them up with the health profile and diet when you do pull from that profile.
Sifter.shop. From the farm to your belly, today is National Dessert Day. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Lots and lots of news today. Why don't we start with hometown classic, McDonald's, testing Beyond Meat burgers in 8 markets, but not locally. That's very exciting, but are they a little bit late to the game with that?
Certainly. A lot of people have been questioning, hey, all these other fast food giants are already well into this race. Why are you just now coming to the starting line? And part of that is sheer volume. McDonald's has over 18,000 stores in North America. 14,000 of those are in the U.S. So when you're thinking about the size of this market, that's kind of part of why they've been cautious, right? So they have already rolled out this burger to in Sweden, Denmark, Austria, the Netherlands, and in the U.K., much smaller markets. But the partnership is with Beyond Meat. And I think a lot of questions were, who can handle that volume? So Beyond Meat right now is the winner for this test. They're going to be testing in 8 cities. So two suburbs of Dallas, Irving and Carrollton, Texas. Cedar Falls, Iowa is probably the closest one to us. There's two in Louisiana and then two in the Los Angeles area. They're going to call it the McPlant. And it's made with rice, peas, and potatoes. Now, I should note, it does come with mayo and cheese, and it's cooked on the same grill as beef and eggs. So it is not vegan, but it is, you know, a step towards that direction for people that want a plant-based option, for sure. I think the test will be really interesting because they have been pretty clear that this is going to be about learning. This is going to be about data. They want to see, how does it sell? What kind of complexity does this add to kitchens? So a lot of franchisees during the pandemic kind of pushed back a little, said, hey, actually, reducing these menus has helped us out a lot. This has saved us money for items that maybe aren't ordered as often. So I think that's a big thing to measure too, because one thing I'm so fascinated by is in the drive-through wars with fast food companies, seconds result in millions of dollars on their P&L. So shaving just, you know, 5 seconds off your drive-through time ends up, you know, winning races for different fast food companies. So I think that's going to be the big thing that they measure.
Well, I'm interested because, you know, it's fascinating. If you talk to young people, millennials and younger, there's a lot of them have given up meat. You know, the vegetarian thing is one thing. A lot of them are vegan. Many of them are just saying, you know, I still eat chicken and I eat fish, but there's something about eating a cow and what that contributes to global warming. I'm just not going to do it anymore. In fact, children in my own household have expressed that they really are trying not to buy meat anymore. And so they've, you know, whether it's Beyond Meat or the Impossible Burger that we're seeing in many other chains, I do feel like they have to figure out a way to make this work simply because it's going to be a demand issue.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's so many reasons why people are looking at plant-based alternatives. Some of them are for ethical and animal rights reasons. Some people are just going, hey, I don't want to take up that much of a carbon footprint. I want to reduce my carbon footprint and eat less meat. I know people personally that kind of feel like they're not vegetarian or vegan, but they kind of only eat meat on the weekend or something like that. They really kind of try to keep it low and focus on the plant-based food. And I think a lot of different food manufacturers and restaurant chains are going to have to be answering to this. You know, we've seen Subway has stepped into the plant-based meat arena, and we've seen a lot hit various other fast food restaurants. And of course, Burger King was the leader there. You know, they had that Impossible Whopper out first. They were one of the first. But we're also seeing this moving into retail in different ways. So I think it's only going to continue. We will have to keep tracking it.
No, we certainly will. So this week we saw William Shatner blasted into space, oldest person to ever go into space, age 90. Boy, does he look great as he came out of there dancing, you know, after his 15 minutes in space. But CNBC is reporting that $10 billion has been invested in the space sector this year, which is a record number. But to me, I guess I'm surprised it's not more money. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I had the same reaction. Not surprising that it's a record year, $10 billion. But I also kind of figured, for as much as space and the kind of the space race, the billionaire space race has been occupying our brains this year, I feel like I would have guessed that number would have been a bit bigger. I will be very interested to see what happens next year when we're looking at that number. So as you mentioned, CNBC had a really interesting report on this. They were using data from Space Capital, which is a New York-based firm that tracks all of this. They were looking at this is a number I was surprised by. They're tracking 1,654 companies that have raised a total of more than $231 billion in cumulative global equity investment since 2012 across these three space categories. So they're looking at infrastructure, distribution, and application. So across all of that, that's such a huge number when you really kind of look at that. For as much press, I think, as the space race has gotten this year, we've seen some high-profile things like William Shatner that you mentioned. We've seen, you know, Elon Musk and and Jeff Bezos kind of trolling each other, and certainly Richard Branson in on that too.
Right.
I think it'd be interesting to see what happens next year, how companies and investment responds to that, saying, okay, this is definitely a thing. Perhaps now we are in the time of space tourism, not really in reach for most of us, but for people in the upper echelons of income, perhaps it will be very soon. And so I think that'll be really interesting to see the number next year in terms of how much this stirred up, what this inspired people to do.
Yeah, no, there's no question about it. It's going to be the new wealthy, happy graduation present for somebody in that family. WGN radio reporter Amy Guth, thank you for bringing us all the news and more. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks so much, Elise.